The words organic and natural are thrown around rather freely these days, but what do they actually mean? And lately, another phrase has been added to the mix, sustainable farming. It's a movement with the goal of encouraging shoppers to buy foods from sustainable farmers, which means buying locally grown produce and meat. Catherine Leiner has written a book about the movement called Growing Roots, which includes over 50 interviews with the next generation of farmers and food activists from all over the United States, among them Jen Small and Mike Yezzi, who raise heritage pigs at Flying Pigs Farm in Shushan, New York. They all visited our studio back in April, and listeners told us that they enjoyed the segment, so we thought we would rebroadcast it as we start this long holiday weekend. I began by asking Catherine, are there laws that set standards for using the word organic?
There are indeed.
So why do we have so much trouble with the word?
Well, I think that a lot of people find it offensive because it means that they are limited in some fashion. But actually, you might know exactly what the laws of that are.
Aren't they a bit fuzzy, actually?
Well, the rules are clear, but people's images of what that means, what the word organic means. People come to us sometimes and say, are you organic? And we say, no, we're not. We raise rare heritage breed pigs out on pasture, no animal byproducts or antibiotics in the feed. They're humanely raised. And they say, oh, so you are organic. But the feed that we feed them is sometimes raised with synthetic chemicals or it may be genetically modified. So it's some of the breeders we work with may not be organic. So we don't meet the technical definition, but what folks are looking for when they look for organic is a certain quality, whether it's humanely or sustainable, and that's what they attach to that. And so it's the difference between the legal definition and people's images.
But Jen, isn't sustainable farming just traditional farming, the way farming has always been done?
Ideally, sustainable is traditional, and you're absolutely right. We want to be producing, whether that be livestock or vegetables or fruits, in a way that is good for the environment and that the land can sustain and that even our human resources can sustain.
I throw this out to all of you. Did you grow up in households that were conscious of where food came from and how it was prepared?
I did. I certainly did. My mother would not allow any white bread. I remember my grandmother saying, the whiter the bread, the sooner you're dead, which, of course, I had no idea what that meant.
Where were you growing up?
I grew up in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. And the white bread there is much deadlier than it is here
in New
York.
Probably. But, you know, nothing came into our house which my mother knew the farmer. She knew the face of the farmer. And that was, you know, 50s and 60s.
Well, were you able to do the same sort of thing with your kids? It's not so easy to get children to eat what's good for them.
Well, I think if that's all you have in your house, then they don't have much of a choice. But I think like I did, my children did, they certainly wanted sweets and so forth, and they got them.
Jen, I'm assuming that your kids have no choice but to eat what you grow on the farm.
Our children have no idea how well they eat. We do our shopping at the green markets, and we come home with these piles of wonderful fruits and vegetables, and they eat our meats and our neighbors' meat, and they have no idea how fortunate they are. They're much too young to realize that.
Now, you shop at the green market because you also sell at the green market. We're talking about the Union Square Green Market also.
Mm-hmm. We're at Union Square
on
Fridays and Saturdays and at Grand Army Plaza in Brooklyn. And the farmers trade. We all trade with one another, and I often go home with a pile of oysters from Blue Moon Fish or something like that in exchange for sliced ham. It's a great deal.
And Mike, couldn't you just grow some vegetables on your land?
We could.
Or do the pigs take up all the space?
They don't take up all the space, but it's sort of a division of labor. Folks like Pathanroth are much better at growing carrots and so many varieties of delicious carrots than we are. And so it's a lot easier for us to take advantage of that
Although, as somebody who tries to grow tomatoes and other things on my little terrace, there's something special about the one that you grew, isn't there?
Absolutely.
The kids definitely have a little garden that they do each year, and they grow some tomatoes, and they pull up a couple carrots. But we still get plenty from the green markets. In fact, Jane has a reputation in school as the one who brings in the real carrots. She doesn't have the shaved little carrot nubs. She has the ones that actually has the greens on it. And all the kids stop at lunch when she pulls that out of her lunchbox. So
the shaved ones are actually old carrots where they have shaved all the old stuff off, and you just wind up with what's left.
Well, there's a funny story that Peter tells at your stand in Union Square about how some folks really want eggs that still have the feathers on them, so that they know that they are actually from a real live chicken.
So how did you get into pig farming? Did you grow up on farms?
No, neither of us did, but we did it. We came to the farm that we were at because we wanted to keep it from being developed. It's next door to where Jen's father grew up and where she spent her summer, so it was an area that was important to her and her family. And a developer wanted to carve it up into house lots, so we purchased it to keep that farm, which had been farming for 200 years, from being lost.
And you also maintain, you keep the farm going, and you also manage to hold full-time office jobs?
I have another job with American Farmland Trust, which works in New York and across the country to prevent farmland from being developed.
So is pig farming that easy that you can work 9 to 5 at another job and still keep the pig farm going?
I help manage the farm with Michael and oftentimes work the farmer's market. But, you know, the entire experience of protecting this 200 acres from development, it really opened our eyes to the economic pressures farmers face. And oftentimes they feel that they must sell it to development because it might be the only way they can retire, for example, and get some cash for that one asset that they have. So it's actually a pleasure to continue to work with farmers across the state to keep land from being developed.
But how did you wind up with pigs, of all things? You could have
found
something easier with less of a waste problem.
You know, I did not. I was one of those people who liked meat on a foam tray, and I couldn't imagine that I would raise an animal and slaughter it. So we certainly came from pigs in a circuitous route, Michael.
We looked at everything, and we were both working off farm, so we couldn't milk anything twice a day, or we didn't know if we'd have a knack for it. So we looked at a variety of things, and neighbors said, well, get some pigs. You get them in the spring, you get rid of them in the fall. you know, if it doesn't work out, you don't have a huge investment. So we started out with 3 pigs, and that turned into 14 and then 57. And in 2006, it was January, and we had 130 pigs, and we decided somebody better start doing this full time. So I've been doing it full time since then. But the fact that Jen still works off the farm speaks to some of the problems with our agricultural system, and that Jen provides health insurance. That's one of the things that, in addition to her love for, you know, the importance of preserving farmland, but it's the story of so many farms in the country, is that somebody has to work off the farm to provide the health insurance, to provide extra income, and it's basically subsidizing the cost of the farm products by that person having to work off the farm.
Don't pigs create a certain waste problem?
When they're raised in the sort of quote-unquote modern methods, they do.
Like factory farms.
Factory farms, you're concentrating thousands of animals in a small location, and you're creating a concentration of the nutrients in the waste. We rotate our pigs through our fields and woods, and so instead of creating a waste problem, they're fertilizing it. They're taking care of brush, tilling in the leaves and the sort of organic material in the woods, grazing the grasses, and so it's more of enhancing it than creating a waste problem.
Catherine, you spoke to a lot of farmers and other people in preparing this book. Did you find many of the farmers were like Jen and Mike? Or I would assume most farmers come out of farm families.
No, actually. Most of the farmers who I have met, one of the things traveling back and forth across the United States, one of the things I learned was that 50% of our farmers are over 65, 25% of them are over 75, only 6% of them are 35 and under. And these folks are extremely well educated. Many of them, most of them, have come to farming not from family farms, although there are some that have, but they are people who, some of them have been out of work, lost their jobs. They look at farming as a way to be not only sustainable in terms of what they eat, but sustainable in terms of how they live.
So they're more likely to become sustainable farmers than old-time farmers who have gotten caught up in the system as it's developed over the years.
I think they're going into it as small farmers. My daughter is a perfect example. She was working in here in Manhattan, and she was very unhappy. And she fell in love with a farmer. He was not a farmer by birth or had not been handed down to him, and now she is indeed a farmer. Farmer girl.
You, many of the people you spoke to are in Colorado.
Many of them are in Colorado.
That's because that's where you live?
I live there part-time. I live in New York City part-time in Colorado.
Is farming the same across the country, or would Coloradans have a different attitude toward farming?
Well, interestingly enough, Jen and I were talking this morning about how there's a very low obesity rate in Colorado. And yet there are lots of ranchers and big farmers, but the farmers that I spoke to were all sustainable and, you know,
throwing that
world around again.
It must have changed because when I lived in Denver some many years ago, everybody ate beef for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And they always thought I was strange because I would order other things like Rocky Mountain trout. They'd say, well, don't you know the Rocky Mountain trout is caught here? It's sent to Seattle, where it is processed and then sent back here frozen. So you're really not eating anything all that healthy.
That's true.
Has that changed, I hope?
Well, you know, there are now trout farms, you know. I mean, the fishing world has changed as well. But there are huge numbers of small farmers. And when I say small farmers, the ones that I interviewed are, you know, they've got 400, 500 acres,
That's a small farm?
James Ranch.
Mm-hmm. In New York State, I think the average farm is less than 200 acres. So
right.
Certainly agriculture across the country is very different.
And what would be the size of a typical factory farm? Your competition, for example, in the pig world, what would be somebody who really is making a lot of money from it?
In fact, their operation would be smaller because they're concentrating animals in a much smaller area. So they're putting 25,000 animals in a 30 by 100 foot barn. We have 200 acres and they would have just a few.
My guests are Mike Izzy and Jen Small of Flying Pigs Farm in Sushan, New York, and Catherine Leiner, who has written a book called Growing Roots, The New Generation of Sustainable Farmers, Cooks, and Food Activists. It is from Sunrise Lane and has lots of pictures and stories and recipes. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with an interview I did last month with Catherine Leiner, who's written a book called Growing Roots, The New Generation of Sustainable Farmers, Cooks, and Food Activists, and Jen Small and Mike Izzy of Flying Pigs Farm in Washington County, New York. They're featured in the book. We're replaying my conversation with them for you now. I asked Catherine Leiner, how many farmers did you interview altogether?
Well, I interviewed 150, but there are only 54 in the book.
How did you meet Jen and Mike?
It's a great story. I called Gabrielle Langholtz, who at the time she headed up the Green Market in New York, and I said, I'm starting this book, and my daughter had just left home, and I was looking to, you know, rediscover my own roots and so forth, and I told her a little bit about the book.
This was an empty nest problem?
This was an empty nest problem. And she said, you've got to meet Mary Cleaver. So we went down. Mary Cleaver owns the Green Table, which is a fabulous restaurant. And we sat down to a full table full of the most divine food. And Mary began by talking. I had known that she actually had, at time of 9/11, she had gotten a grant to buy pork from Michael and Jen and fed all of the recovery workers down at 9/11. And so I was very happy to meet her anyway. The first person that she said I had to meet were Jen and Mike, so I promptly did it.
And you have heritage breed pigs. What does that mean?
So they're rare breed, heritage breed pigs are pigs that were around 150 years ago. Older styles of pigs, not modern hybrids. And the rare breeds are varieties that didn't do well in the industrial system, were bred for lard, which was very important in our country and in agriculture. It was a lot, great way to store calories, use it for lubrication, candles, soap, everything. So having a pig that had a lot of it was very beneficial. But in the modern system, it was not advantageous. So leaner pigs, more efficient pigs, pigs that do well in confinement were the ones selected. So the varieties we raise are rare. They've been left alone. They haven't had all the fat and flavor bred out of them. They do well outside. So they have great flavor. I think one of the best compliments we get is when people say, this reminds me of pork from my grandparents' farm.
Ruth Reichel, who used to be the editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine, would always complain about the fact that pigs have been bred, all the fat has been bred out of pigs, and that takes all the flavor out. But would I really be able to taste the difference between a pork chop from one of your pigs or a ham from one of your pigs as opposed to something that had been bred on a factory farm?
Yes. Catherine Liner says yes.
Absolutely. And we want to make sure that we keep that edge. So on occasion, though it's been years and years since we bought supermarket pork, every once in a while we buy pork from any of the other producers, and I'm sure some ends up as supermarket pork, and we do a blind taste test just to be sure. But it's actually astonishing, and it's sort of like, though, Leonard, like eating a strawberry in June, one of those wonderful small tri-stars you get versus one of the hard white ones you get from California. That's how different it really tastes. And I think there's not just us, but now there's many, many producers raising rare breed pigs out on pasture. So we encourage people to find their local farmer.
And there are restaurants that are featuring the fact that they sell Berkshire style pigs or whatever.
Berkshires are interesting. They are indeed a heritage breed pork, but they're not a rare breed in need of conservation. In fact, Berkshires are often raised in confinement in this country.
Hmm. I didn't know that. I just assumed that it was that they were raised in a better way because they are singled out on the menu. You have young children. I understand that pigs make wonderful pets. Have they ever gotten attached to any of the pigs?
They don't, fortunately. My mother tells the story when she was growing up on a visiting her grandparents' farm, and they always had three pigs each year, and every year they named them the same thing, Bacon, Ham, and Sausage. And it was very clear what was going to happen to those pigs. So I think the goal is you take very good care of them while they're alive and you treat them with great care. But, they do meet, there's no bones about it, a swift death, and they become meat for us.
Do you have to deal with problems like illnesses? Because one of the things that we see in factory farms is that they put antibiotics in the feed and automatically to eliminate any illness. They give them hormones to make them grow faster. I'm assuming you're not doing that, but what do you do with a sick pig?
We do what we do with our children. We keep an eye on them. We look for any sort of differences in behavior that might indicate that they aren't feeling well. And if they do, we'll take them out of the field. We'll put them in the barn. We'll get them in a nice, warm, dry environment. And then we'll give them the appropriate treatment. If they need to be on antibiotics because they're sick, we'll give them the appropriate treatment. And then when they're better, we stop. I tell folks it's like your children. When they're sick, you give them the medicine they need. And when they're healthy, you stop.
In January, Catherine, the FDA proposed that food standards would be raised in school cafeterias around the country. I'm assuming you think that's a positive step, although there are politicians who are declaring this as part of a movement toward a nanny state.
A nanny state. Well, I think we do need to take care of our children, let's face it. And the fact that Bloomberg has managed to get sodas out of schools I find to be great because that gives children perhaps other choices. I think Michelle Obama is working very, very hard to see to it that this happens across the nation. Nanny state. I feel like children should have in schools as good food as they can possibly get so that they in turn can grow up and learn.
Do the FDA's latest proposed food standards affect your work? Mike?
There's some. It does affect. There will be impact on even small farms. But we're waiting to see how everything's rolled out to see what it's going to be.
Well, I will say that in the state, in Durango, Colorado, where I live part-time, there are 8 elementary schools, and all 8 of those elementary schools are now getting their food from the farmers. And we'd like to see more of that happen across the nation.
One of the people in your book is the president of Slow Food USA, Josh Viertel. He worked on Time for Lunch, a campaign that encouraged citizens to get their legislators to invest in healthier food and link schools to local farms. Has there been much progress in that?
I think there's been a lot of progress. I mean, when you think about what's going on at the moment, we need to actually get this passed so that the lunch programs can be changed. And Josh has been very instrumental in his work at Slow Foods in doing that.
One of the arguments that Slow Foods and some other activists is that the factory farms are subsidized, but sustainable farms, the smaller farms, are not. And that's why it's so much more expensive to eat healthy food.
Well, we tell folks.
Can you get subsidies?
No, because we don't raise any crops. So we aren't into any of the subsidy programs. There are some conservation programs, but those aren't really the big subsidy programs. But we do tell people that our products have all the costs in there. We aren't getting, property tax breaks, development. We aren't putting those costs of the waste problem, whether it's air, water, soil pollution. We aren't putting there aren't the health impacts that some of the factory produced and processed foods have. So all the costs are in there. A neighbor of mine says, you can pay me. When people ask about it, you can pay me or you can pay your doctor. It's all the same to me.
When people come to your booths at the Green Market, are they interested in how you care for your pigs before you slaughter them?
Absolutely. I think people come to our stand at Green Markets and they come with a wide variety of needs. Some come, frankly, just for taste and flavor. But many, many come for animal welfare. And that's an example, for example, where we don't meet the certified organic standards. In fact, we dramatically exceed animal welfare standards that are for certified organic. That, frankly, is probably the most important thing for me on how we raise our pigs. And just as Mike said, if an animal's ill, we'll treat it with an antibiotic because I can't stand to see an animal suffer.
Catherine, we have less than a minute, but how do you answer people who say that terms like organic, natural, sustainable are all elitist?
Well, I think Josh answers that question very well. And for me personally, what I would say is, some of us have more discretionary funds than others. And what I would like to do with my few that I have is I'd rather spend mine on grass-fed pork one time a week than feedlot or conventional meat, which is obviously less expensive, and eat that every day. I'd rather eat more organic vegetables and fruits than cooped up chicken twice a week. I just want my food to taste like real food, and I don't want hormones, herbicides, pesticides. And whether that's elitist or maybe it is that I just have learned that that's a choice.
Catherine Leiner's book, Growing Roots, The New Generation of Sustainable Farmers, Cooks, and Food Activists, is from Sunrise Lane Books. We've also been talking with Jen Small and Mike Yezzi of Flying Pigs Farm in Washington County, New York. Thank you all so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.